Hey there, Rick Singeri of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont is justly proud of the fact that a once denuded landscape is now largely covered by forest land. But keeping that land wooded requires maintenance, policies, and perhaps a revenue source that gives landowners the ability to preserve the woods they own. There are lots of ways to manage a forest for tree health while also making some money, but an increasingly appealing way coincides with states, companies, and countries seeking out ways to offset their carbon usage. Vermont has been part of a regional greenhouse gas initiative known as REGI for about a decade, but new markets are expanding the possibilities, and people who work in this field are trying to group relatively smaller landowners together to market their land for these programs. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to look at the science of carbon storage, the politics of carbon markets, and the bottom line environmental impact of this kind of carbon offset solution. Joining us for the discussion is Bill Keaton, professor of forest ecology and forestry at UVM. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And Jim Shallow, Director of Strategic Conservation Initiatives for the Vermont Chapter of the Nature Conservancy. Jim, nice to have you with us.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks.
Can we start with the basics and just go over what carbon storage is in the first place and how it works? So why our forests are valuable for carbon storage and carbon offsets? Which of you wants to tackle that basic science question?
Well, maybe I'll start off,
okay,
Jane.
Go ahead.
Well, as forests grow and develop, they absorb carbon dioxide from the air and they transform that through the process of photosynthesis into biomass, both living and dead. And that biomass accumulates over time. And as it does, it's adding carbon that's basically in the bank. It's stored in the bank of forests. And if transformed back into carbon dioxide through cutting or burning or something else, it would be re-released to the atmosphere as a greenhouse gas, as carbon dioxide. So the carbon markets are trying to encourage landowners to keep carbon stored in their forests in the form of biomass.
So it's basically just keeping the carbon stored instead of releasing it, not necessarily recapturing things that have already been going out into the atmosphere.
Well, there's a little bit of the recapture going on because the trees are absorbing that carbon that we are pumping into the air every day through our industrial activities, and that's creating that blanket of carbon that's warming our atmosphere. So the trees are playing a little bit of a role in actually recapturing that carbon.
But that's not the main function of the carbon market.
It's actually, Jim's got a good point there. It's really all aspects of that carbon cycle, both the sequestration, the uptake of carbon from the atmosphere, the storage in the forest, on the land long term, and also the carbon that is harvested and goes into wood products. That's accounted for as well. So it's that whole carbon cycle.
Okay, so if we understand that the forests here are key to this and having forested land, and actually, you know, there are a lot of specifics to that, not just, hey, I got a couple of trees on my landscape. Can I get involved in a carbon market? But so we've got this forest land. And then how do the carbon markets work? Just a fundamental sense of what a carbon market is.
So the real basic concept is that the carbon market is looking for a way to purchase carbon. So think of it as another forest product. We're all used to talking about maple sugar and trees being used for timber and lumber and, you know, furniture and things like that. This is another market. It's a forest product that's available to us now through these markets. And they're looking for, is that project that's offering up the carbon, are they real? You know, so can we verify that that carbon's being stored? Are they additional? So is the practice there actually doing more to store carbon than maybe what was going on there before? Are they measurable? So can we measure the amount of carbon actually being stored? And then lastly, can we verify that that's all accurate? So all of that needs to be in place in order for a project to go forward and say, we have carbon that's real and you can purchase.
But the purchaser, the entity that is trying to do the purchasing, this is a simplified way to talk about it, but isn't it basically a polluter who's looking for a way to offset that pollution by buying carbon from a place where there is not that pollution, basically?
Yeah. So, Jane, you did a great job of explaining it. This is a vastly complicated topic. We could spend hours on it, but I'll try to summarize it really briefly. So one thing right off the bat is to understand the distinction between the two major types of carbon markets that there are. There are compliance markets, also called cap and trade. A cap is set on the total emissions of carbon from various sectors like power generators or transportation or manufacturers, and then that cap is reduced over time. And the regulated sectors as part of that market, and I'm thinking of the California market, which is the dominant market right now in North America, have to meet a certain emissions reduction obligation. Now, the California system is they have to reduce 92% of their emissions at the stack, at the tailpipe, so to speak, like real emissions reductions. But 8% of their emissions reductions obligations can be met through the purchase of offsets. And offsets can come from forestry, they can come from land conservation, they can come from renewable energy, a whole variety of things. So that's the way the compliance markets work. Then there's this whole other breed of carbon markets called voluntary markets that are truly international in scope. Polluters anywhere in the world can buy from an offset generator anywhere else in the world. And that's actually another very significant opportunity for landowners in Vermont, but it's a little different from the compliance markets. In this case, an offset generator, like a forest landowner here, is selling these emission offsets directly to a buyer somewhere else that's made a commitment to reducing their carbon footprint. And that could be a country like Norway's an example. It could be a company like Disney or Ford or British Petroleum. It could be an institution like a university or a municipality or a school or a variety of things. But it's considered an over-the-counter transaction directly from the emissions offset generator to the buyer somewhere else.
And in terms of that voluntary market, that there are a lot of companies, for example, that say, we want to be greener, we want to do the right thing, we're an airline, but we're going to buy these carbon offsets. So they might be, for example, an example of somebody who's buying on that voluntary market.
That's right.
And that market is growing. We've seen in the last year, it's had its best year ever. And that's there are people that are speculating that, you know, the Paris Accords are driving people to think about their emissions. And then paradoxically, our pulling out of the climate accords has also driven companies to buy more offsets because they've made commitments to stay in the accords. There's a climate alliance out there that has 15 states here in the United States that have committed to meeting those goals. And so those companies that are also committed to doing that are looking for ways to reduce their carbon emissions.
See, it was a good thing we pulled out.
Let's not go there.
So let's talk a little bit about how Vermont is getting involved, how Vermont landowners are getting involved. Jim, I know you're involved in this as well through the Nature Conservancy and a parcel of land in Montgomery. Why don't you talk about that first, and maybe that'll give us a good example of how this is operating here.
Great. My favorite subject right now.
Gee, I wonder why we have you on the show.
Right. Earlier this summer, we purchased 5,400 acres of land up in Montgomery primarily, and it's a beautiful place. I had the opportunity to walk up there to the top of Burnt Mountain and look out over this vast landscape of trees and three different watersheds. We actually were able to acquire 97% of a watershed for Calavail Brook. So it has all of those co-benefits that come from conserving land. We're protecting the forest, we're protecting the water quality, we're protecting air quality, we're providing places for people to go. And as a result of our decisions that we're going to manage that as a forever wild reserve, of which only 3.2% of Vermont is in that category, we've changed the status of it. So that made us eligible for the California market. So we evaluated—
Which, again, is a compliance market,
Mandatory market. So we looked at that, and the prices are generally higher for carbon in that market. So we looked at that and saw, based on the amount of timber out there, that we had a viable project. And so we are going forward with enrolling in that, and that's going to generate some income for the Nature Conservancy. Rough estimates are about $2 million over the next 10 years, and we will be turning that money around to do more forest conservation work in the state of Vermont. We know that forest conservation work is restricted right now because there just aren't a lot of sources for funding for this. So we're trying to be innovative and take advantage of these new markets, and Burnt Mountain is a perfect example of our ability to take advantage of that market.
So this is land that you would want to preserve and conserve anyway, right? And so is this a way to actually make that sustainable in terms of having a financial benefit or a financial return so that you can either buy more land or you know, basically make it something that can be a little bit of a revenue generator?
It is generating revenue for us that we will be putting back towards our mission of protecting our land and water that's important to people and nature.
Okay, but so that's one example, and that's a large parcel of land. I mean, more than 5,000 acres.
Yes.
is big, and most single landowners in Vermont don't have anywhere near that amount of land. But there are ways, we talked about the voluntary market, where Vermont landowners might be able to participate. And Bill, can you talk a little bit about how that works, how much land you have to have, you know, what it requires for a landowner to start participating and be part of a carbon market?
Sure, I'd be glad to. So as I answer that question, I just want to be sure and acknowledge the partners that I've been working with on that very question. They are the Vermont Land Trust. I'm on their board of trustees, so proud to represent them as well. And then we've also partnered with a group called Spatial Informatics Group that's done a lot of the heavy lifting for us on the quantitative analysis. So we just completed a feasibility study on this very question. And for any of the listeners interested, if they just Google Vermont Forest Carbon, you'll find that feasibility study report.
We also have it linked on our webpage for today.
Oh, okay, great. And so in that study, we basically asked the question, you know, what would it take to really get forest carbon projects going here in Vermont, given the landscape that we have, which you're right, is mostly in those smaller parcel sizes of, you know, a couple hundred acres or so. And, after taking a really hard look at this, we've concluded that the potential is high here, very high. There are a lot of opportunities that would directly benefit landowners. But it's primarily going to be through those voluntary markets, and it's going to require something called aggregation, in which several landowners, they don't have to be adjacent, they just have to be within the same general region or area.
And how is a region delineated?
It's delineated based on ecological boundaries, something we call ecoregions or physiographic provinces. But all this is on the web, and a landowner can find the
Do I need to pair up with other Vermonters or like other New Englanders, or is it more like I need to pair up with other people in, you know,
think of it as
County?
A landscape, like the Taconics or Northern Vermont or the Champlain Valley or something like that.
Got it.
Sort of on that scale. Yeah. And so they would need to basically pool their resources and agree to work together as part of this larger aggregated project. And by doing it that way, they gain certain economies of scale. They're able to generate enough credit yield by selling these offsets on the market to not only cover their transaction costs, the cost of enrolling and developing the project, but then also generating a sufficient revenue, a profit, to really make this financially attractive. And in this feasibility study, we've not only done the financial analysis to show that that profit could actually be fairly attractive in certain situations, but that also this would have real benefits for the Vermont landscape. We've literally mapped out where these parcels are statewide, the parcels that are most eligible for carbon market participation, and the parcels that would have the greatest other kinds of benefits or values for the Vermont environment. And we define those very specifically in terms of open space conservation, conserving large unfragmented forest blocks that have been mapped statewide, and also the parcels that have the greatest flood protection benefit. And so running the numbers and doing that spatial analysis, we've shown that this is a very real and attractive opportunity for Vermont. And if you're interested, I could give you some of those actual numbers.
Yeah, I mean, especially that question of return on investment or how, you know, how basically covering the transactional costs. Because you can imagine somebody with 200 acres, say, and you expect that maybe there could be a return of $16 an acre per year. Now, if you only have 1 acre, obviously $16 a year is not going to do much for you. But you're talking about people who have a couple hundred acres at least. So yeah, it could be a couple $1,000 or more, depending on how much you have. But is that really worth whatever hassle it is to get yourself into the program and maintain your land?
I think want to weigh in on this, so I'll do it quickly. But so we approached this using an actual example of a collection of landowners up in northern Vermont around the Jay Peak area, and they're part of an initiative called Cold Hollow to Canada, really interesting effort up there. And we pulled together about 5,500 acres of land and modeled out the finances and showed that they generate almost $1 million. I think it was $900,000 in total net profit after all the expenses have been paid. Everything's been covered over 10 years. And you're right, that worked out to $16 per acre per year per landowner, which is not bad. But from a forestry standpoint or a landowner standpoint, you have to see that revenue as supplementary. It's additive on top of all the other revenue streams they're already capturing from sustainable forestry, so sustainable timber harvest, cost share programs, maple syrup and non-timber forest products.
Because you're allowed to do other things with your land.
All those other things can be accommodated, or property tax abatement through the current use value appraisal program. So it's an additional incentive on top of all of those other things. And here's the real key point for the listeners. We think that this is a great way to help keep working forests in business and help to keep that Vermont forested landscape intact.
And Jim Chalo, you wanted to weigh in too.
I did, because I think Bill's study is great in the fact that it pointed out the opportunities that aggregation gives us, but it also points out that what's key to these projects is that we're doing these what we call co-benefits. So there's all this other benefit of water quality and habitat protection. The Cold Hollow area he mentions is that key connector between the Northern Greens and Canada. So wildlife, as we think about a resilient future going forward with climate change, is going to need that area to sort of move north. And, I think this opportunity is sort of tapping into the wishes of those landowners to sort of do those things as well. So it's not, in a way, it's not a burden because their values are there. And working from those values, we're now finding a market to, in a sense, incentivize those values.
Right. People are not starting from scratch here.
That's right. So it's less of a burden, more of a recognition that they're providing all of us with a service, an ecosystem service that we are creating markets for the first time ever that are going to give them the recognition for that.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're looking at how carbon markets are evolving and where Vermont fits into an increasingly national and international picture. With us today are Bill Keaton, professor of forest ecology and forestry at UVM. Bill is also a Vermont Land Trust board member. And Jim Chalo, director of strategic conservation initiatives for the Vermont chapter of the Nature Conservancy. And let's go to Sister Lorien, who's calling in from Berlin. Hi, Sister Lorien. Go right ahead.
Hello. I have a concern that I understand it. Vermont has goals that the kind of thing you're talking about can't be used towards Vermont goals because it's given to people outside the state. I want to be reassured.
Thanks for the call,
That's
Sister Lorien.
Question.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So how does this factor into Vermont's own environmental goals when we're selling our forest, selling our carbon offsets from our forests to California?
That's a great question. Very astute question. So, how to approach this one? Well, the caller is absolutely right that if we're selling the offset outside of the state, that offset will be essentially retired somewhere else, which means that we can't double count it.
And which has been a problem in the past, hasn't it?
It has been.
Yes,
there have been a variety of problems and issues like that have come up over the years. And we've seen the markets respond to those by really tightening up their protocol and their rules. And so these are robust systems that would not allow you to double count something like that. And so that's true. That might be a factor in terms of Vermont meeting its own emissions reductions goals. But from a planetary standpoint, and in terms of the overall Earth's climate, it's a good thing to fight climate change however we can. And if Vermont can contribute to that broader global effort to fight climate change, I see that as a positive. I'll just mention that in terms of benefits right here at home, I think one of the reasons that Jim and I are so excited about this potential is that this kind of working forest conservation through carbon market participation will have other real benefits, again, in terms of conserving working forest lands, to helping to maintain that unfragmented forest landscape, larger blocks of working forest, and then, as we've shown in this feasibility study, also helping to conserve parcels that are really important for flood protection and flood resilience. That's something that we've actually mapped out and quantified. So I would encourage the listener to think about all these other co-benefits that this would provide.
But when we talk about the sort of bottom line environmental impact. You were talking, Professor Keaton, earlier about California, for example, which in its own laws around emissions says that it has to be source point emission reduction for more than 90% towards their goals. But then this 8%, I guess you could sort of look at it as we're probably never going to get to the point where, you know, there are no cars, there are no factories, where there are no carbon emissions. So there's always going to be some pollution. So the idea is then you're offsetting it with this forest land elsewhere. But really, it's a wash, right? I mean, it's polluters getting credits and the forest providing those credits. So there's no, you know, I get the co-benefits, but in terms of the carbon, it's really a wash, right? I mean, it's like balancing out?
No, probably not.
Why?
So in our example of a burnt mountain, that land was available for harvesting, and it would have been harvested. And the timber coming off of that could have been potentially chipped, burnt. The carbon would have gone into the atmosphere. So there are a lot of uses that could have happened that actually would have put carbon into the atmosphere there. Our decision not to harvest that parcel going forward forever is allowing us to store that carbon forever.
But it's also allowing somebody else to pollute and use your carbon as the way to sort of get out of jail.
So now you're getting into the intricacies of a cap and trade. So, and I've heard that criticism, but the cap and trade, what it's doing is the cap keeps going down.
3% every year.
3% every year with the goal to be below 1990 emissions fairly soon, and then below that going forward.
This is for California.
For California.
80% below by 2050.
Yeah, thank you.
And they're 2 years ahead of schedule.
Yeah, so they're moving ahead. And now all of that isn't being done by buying carbon offsets. There's a lot of other work going on. So it's helping that. But I would say it's not a wash. I would say there's additive benefit to these projects. And in fact, you have to demonstrate that there's additive benefit.
Well, let's take on the criticism on the voluntary market, though, which is, you know, a legitimate concern, I think, that a lot of people have. And I think to demonstrate that this is going to result in real emissions reductions, we have to hold these companies accountable and the institutions and the other buyers. You know, they've made a commitment to reduce their carbon footprint. We're not going to let them do that exclusively through the purchase of offsets. That's just one part of the overall reduction portfolio, if you will, and it's going to require other efforts to ensure that their overall emissions come down. And then also at larger scales, sort of regional, national scales, we have to ensure that the carbon stocks are increasing overall in the landscape and our emissions are coming down overall. And so those are essential pieces of this.
Let's go to Mike in Colchester. Hi, Mike. What's your question?
I actually have a question and then a suggestion. But my question is, I listened to all of this conversation, and some time ago, last year, the year before, there were a large portion of the Democratic legislature here in Vermont wanted to institute a carbon tax. So I'd like you to explain what the carbon tax has to do with all the other carbon credits and so forth that you are talking about. And the last thing is, my suggestion is, I think for all of us to fully understand what you two are talking about, you need to capture some of our old terms for this, because you're not making it clear.
You so, really like aren't. What, Mike? What terms are you looking for?
Well, carbon credits. I mean, I look at that as forest products.
Yeah.
As an example, I know that's not all of what it is, but you know, and another carbon credit. What about solar?
Yeah,
you're just not making.
Mike, I hear you. I hear what you're saying. Your phone line's about sort of going downhill right here. But yes, that question of, first of all, how does it make sense to people? And I think, Jim Shallow, you mentioned at the beginning, you think of it the same way you think of maple syrup as a forest product. Carbon is a forest product. So more to what Mike is saying there in terms of, like, yes, this is the language we use. But how does a carbon tax fit into what we're talking about here?
So it's complementary and can be disruptive as well. So, it all depends on how it's structured. Here in Vermont, our conversation around a carbon tax has been largely trying to address getting our cars and our homes off of carbon energy and moving it towards more renewable energy. And so all the talk around that has been how to sort of change the marketplace for that, which would complement the work that's going on here, where we're also trying to store and capture more carbon as well. In other places, for instance, Colombia, which has a carbon tax, they've allowed companies who can't who participate in the voluntary markets to actually use some of those offsets to lower their tax bill. So there's ways to structure that, that the two can be complementary to each other.
But in terms of an individual in Vermont somewhere down the line perhaps seeing a carbon tax on every gallon of gasoline they buy, then they're obviously not buying offsets
individually. That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah, these are fundamentally different mechanisms. Yeah. You know, one is a tax-based approach. The other is a market-based approach. Think of it using the free market basically to incentivize people to do good forestry and help fight climate change at the same time. But Mike asked a great question about terminology, and we should acknowledge that this is a really confusing, complicated topic, and there's so much that one needs to come up to speed on. But to address his question about credits and what those really are, the currency here is basically one metric ton of carbon dioxide equivalent, and that equates to one credit that can be sold on a market. Now, that ton of carbon dioxide equivalent can be stored in the forest, but it can also be stored in wood products. So the caller was correct there. And that credit has a price associated with it because, again, this is a market mechanism. California market, that credit's trading for about $15 per ton. On the voluntary market, the prices range dramatically, but we think we could get $8 or $10 per ton of CO2 equivalent, i.e. one credit here in Vermont.
We have some questions about Vermont landowners getting into this, and we're going to look at current use and how that applies as well. But first, let's hear from Nick, who says, I'm the second largest owner of timberland in my town with 700 acres. The manner in which the carbon credit proposal is presently constituted would not allow my eligibility for the program, as the minimum acreage requirement is several thousand acres. This means that the program will be of benefit only to the largest industrial forest landowners, even though the majority of privately owned forest land in Vermont is in parcels of less than 100 acres. About half of those are enrolled in the current use program. For the carbon credit initiative to be successful, it must allow smaller acreage owners to enter, perhaps in a collective of smaller parcels, and as a subset of current use owners enrolled with forest management plans, which include a carbon credit element. Before we go to Nick's answer, let's also rope in here Martha, who's on the line with us from Gansevoort, New York, who has a similar question, I think. Martha, go right ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I have 69 acres of forest land, it has a road between the Hudson River and it, but it's got a lot of wildlife, bobcats and, all sorts of, wildlife, and it's very nice from that standpoint, and I was wondering, would that be, something that I could, think of, or would I have to join with other landowners, or how could I participate?
Martha, thanks for the call. Okay, so we have Nick here who's wondering, 700 acres, but he's been hearing that you need more than 1,000. Martha, who's got 69 acres, how could she participate? So go over the numbers again for how landowners with smaller parcels of land might be able to participate in the carbon markets.
Sure. Well, so the point about only larger parcels, let's say 1,000 acres or more in size being eligible, really only applies to the compliance markets, the cap and trade markets.
Like California.
Yeah, and we should stress it's not really strictly eligibility. It's just the economies of scale that you need to generate enough offset credits to cover your costs and make an acceptable profit. So that's
Why does it cost?
A lot of the costs are fixed, and they can range from $10,000 to $100,000 or so, up front, and you need to cover those costs.
Some of the costs that we're engaged with are you have to develop the project. You have to go out and measure the carbon that's in the forest and do multiple plots across your property, and it's a fairly intensive inventory that has to go on. That involves people, involves time, it involves people analyzing that. That's a cost up front. Then you have to do all the paperwork and everything like that. And then once you're enrolled, you've got to keep monitoring that. So they want to make sure that when you sell them that carbon, that's still there in 6, 10, 20 years, 100 years in the California market. Yeah. So those ongoing costs also have to be factored into your stewardship of that property going forward. So all of that adds into if you don't have enough trees above a certain amount, then you're just not going to have enough money coming in to cover your cost of doing the project.
But again, that's for the compliance market, which has some stricter rules.
Same for voluntary as
but
well.
But voluntary, as you're saying,
a little more flexible. But.
Right,
so
and maybe makes more sense
difference.
For smaller ones.
Yeah. The compliance market doesn't currently allow you to aggregate. That's why the individual property needs to be large enough. But for the voluntary markets, we can do aggregation. And so for there, we can go down to property sizes that are more like 200, 300 acres in size. And if we can build a project that's a couple thousand acres or more in size, then you can make it work financially. So for Martha, her property's at the lower end of the spectrum for which this might work. But if she got together with other landowners, maybe with some larger parcels, and they put together something that was a couple thousand acres or more in size, they could make this work. For Nick, 700 acres, I mean, that's right in the sweet spot, actually, just a couple other properties of that size, and they've got a project. And so in this feasibility study, we took a really close look at this, actually, what the potential for aggregated projects is statewide, going down to parcels that are about 500 acres or more in size. And we found 328,000 acres statewide that are in parcels 500 acres or more that would be eligible and suitable for aggregated projects under the voluntary market.
So I know we only have like 30 seconds left, but we've got a couple questions about how Vermont's current use program applies here and some confusion about that.
It's totally, from my understanding right now, this is a very acceptable practice because you're still going to be able to manage the timber for that and meet your current use obligations. You just need to be managing it so that you're storing more carbon in your forest. So it's a supplemental forest product. Just like you're allowed to harvest forest products off your property for current use, this is another forest product.
Well, it's really interesting and, as you said, quite complicated. So I appreciate you guys breaking it down for us as we look here at carbon markets and how Vermont landowners are participating or could participate. Bill Keaton is a professor of forest ecology and forestry at UVM. We have a link to his study that he co-authored at vpr.net. Just click on the Vermont Edition page. Jim Shallow is director of strategic conservation initiatives for the Vermont chapter of the Nature Conservancy. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you, Jane.
It's been great.